You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Today's episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audibletrial.com/evidencelocker and browse through the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audibletrial.com/evidencelocker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Warning: this episode contains details of black magic practice and human and animal sacrifice. It may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. It was April 1989, and Mexican state authorities had set up a roadblock just outside of Matamoros, a town bordering the United States. Drug trafficking was a big problem in these parts, and they routinely set up roadblocks to monitor all vehicles in the area. On this day, however, a car ran through the checkpoint without any attempt to stop. Officers followed the vehicle in an unmarked car. They were amazed at the driver's arrogance. He simply carried on driving as if though he were invisible. After a high-speed pursuit, the car stopped on a desert farm called Rancho Santa Elena. When the man got out of his car, he seemed surprised that the officers could see him, as he believed he was invisible to law enforcement. He even invited police to shoot, as he said the bullets would simply bounce off him. This man was Serafin Hernandez, a member of the Hernandez family drug cartel. In a preliminary search of the property, police found stacks of marijuana and firearms, enough to take Serafin Hernandez into custody. But they had only just hit the tip of the iceberg. In custody, Hernandez spoke candidly about El Padrino, a practitioner of black magic, whose magic protected him and the rest of the family. He promised that Hernandez would be invisible and bulletproof. Three other men were arrested on the farm, and they all confessed to being a part of a cult. With a perverse sense of pride, they told police about their belief in the powers of black magic. Stories of torture and human sacrifices emerged, all in reverence to one man, their high priest, El Padrino Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo. Adolfo Constanzo was born on November 1, 1962, in Miami, Florida. His mother was a young 15-year-old Cuban migrant called Delia Aurora Gonzalez del Valle. Delia would eventually have three children, all to different fathers. Delia was a follower of Santeria, an Afro-Cuban religion. Santeria is known for its rituals, like the initiation ritual of cleansing of the head of a new member with herbs and water. Artifacts like dolls, colored bracelets, and necklaces and iron tools to protect them from evil are essential to followers of the religion. Santeria believes in one supreme god, Olofi, a magical entity that surrounds all humans. Demigods called Orichas are Olofi's messengers, who maintain harmony and righteousness among humans. Orichas are somewhat similar to saints in Catholicism. Practitioners of Santeria worship the Orichas, but they never replace the almighty Olofi. Delia was convinced that her son Adolfo needed extra protection. There was something special about him, she felt. She wanted him to be initiated into Santeria, and as the custom goes, to be consecrated to a particular god or goddess for lifelong protection. So when he was 6 months old, Delia had Adolfo blessed by a Haitian priest who observed Palo Mayombe, a somewhat darker form of Santeria. When Adolfo was still an infant, his father died. Ready for a new start, Delia relocated to San Juan, Puerto Rico. It didn't take her long to find a new man in her life, and the couple married. The only problem was, Delia's new husband was Catholic. Delia agreed to raise their child, along with Adolfo, in the Catholic faith. Adolfo was baptized, and when he was a young kid, served as an altar boy. However, Delia frequently took young Adolfo to Haiti. What her husband thought the purpose of these trips were is unclear, but Delia and Adolfo went as often as they could. They went to learn more about Haitian voodoo, a secret that they would keep between themselves. In Haitian voodoo, as with Santeria, the Supreme Creator doesn't intervene in human lives directly. Spirits called Loa preside over all aspects of life, each Loa being responsible for one particular aspect of life. In order to cultivate a relationship with a Loa, offerings are required. Personal altars with devotional objects set the stage for dancing and singing ceremonies. It is believed that during these ceremonies, spirits take part by possessing individuals and speaking through them. In Haiti, Delia and Adolfo took part in ceremonies like these, dancing and singing and banging on drums to awaken spirits. Typically, a chicken is sacrificed to bring good luck. Different types of drums and the rattling beaded calabashes are played to summon different spirits. Dancers hold an empty glass bottle in one hand and a machete in the other. The bottle signifies a gift to the spirit world, and the machete signifies honor. This carries on until a spirit takes control of you. Then, the possessed person continues dancing in a trance, eyes stark and wide, until the person convulses in erratic fits. Needless to say, this would be quite a confronting experience for any young kid. And reconciling his day-to-day life as an altar boy with practicing Haitian voodoo would be confusing, to say the least. This is a quote from Edward Humes's book, Buried Secrets. Adolfo Constanzo's earliest childhood memory was not a favorite toy or a parent's smile, but the gurgling death rattle of a chicken's slit throat, its blood offered up to the ancient African gods. He knew a home filled with decay and blood, inuring him to death. His reward for good behavior was the gift of an animal to mutilate or kill. There was the power that shedding blood brought, the essence of Santeria. Give blood to the gods, and they will answer your prayers. There was the daily embrace of death and decay inside Delia's filthy home, the basis of Paulo Mayombe's magic. Above all, a Polero must relish the stench of decomposing flesh, for he must take the evil spirits of the dead inside him, becoming possessed by them. The family returned to Miami in 1972 when Adolfo was 10 years old. Shortly after the move, his stepfather passed away. He left Delia with some money, with which they could live comfortably, and finally openly, as followers of voodoo. In Little Havana, where they lived, Delia was said to be a witch. Neighbors reportedly found headless goats or chickens on their doorsteps if they'd had any friction with Delia. She wasn't someone you'd want to anger. Before long, Delia found another husband. This time around, her choice in partner suited her lifestyle much better. He was a local drug dealer, and they had the same religious beliefs. Importantly, he passed some of his philosophies on to budding teenager Adolfo. He believed, "Let the non-believers kill themselves with drugs. We will profit from their foolishness." As a teenager, Adolfo was an apprentice to a local priest following Paulo Mayombe. He wanted to educate himself on how to make a living from his religion. Like Haitian voodoo, Paulo Mayombe involves animal sacrifice. This was nothing new to Adolfo, as he had been encouraged to kill animals from a very young age. Central to Paulo Mayombe is a cast iron cauldron called the Nyanga. Sacrifices would be fed into the Nyanga in order to set a spirit free to provide magical powers. Paulo means stick in Spanish, and that's what goes into the pot along with other elements. During the ritual, a Paulo priest would put 21 sticks, all from different trees, into the Nyanga. Then he would cut himself and let the blood drip into the cauldron before taking the sacrifice. Another powerful ingredient in any Nyanga is human bones. On instruction of the priest, Adolfo started robbing graves in Miami to stock the Nyanga. The charismatic and attractive, well-versed young sorcerer, Adolfo Costanzo, impressed all of his fellow poleros. That is what you call followers of Palo Mayombe. He was said to be able to talk to the dead and to predict the future. In 1981, his mother, Delia, claimed Adolfo had predicted the shooting of Ronald Reagan, for instance. Adolfo wasn't a typical teenager by any means. He and his mom were arrested a couple of times for minor crimes like theft and vandalism. He was also expelled from school. It was around this time that he began cruising gay bars. His natural charm and good looks made him popular with men and women alike, and he never tried to hide his bisexuality. In 1983, Adolfo Costanzo felt he was fulfilling his destiny when he pledged himself to Kadi Yimpembe, the religion's version of Satan. It was only natural that he also became a priest in the cult. Shortly after, the 21-year-old Adolfo went to Mexico City on a modeling assignment and decided to stay for a while. He lived in the infamous La Zona Rosa, or the Pink Zone, known for its colorful LGBTQ community. In the early 1980s, it was quite the place, with many bars, restaurants, and upscale shops. This was the perfect spot for Adolfo to reel in customers as he started reading tarot cards and telling fortunes. However, this sorcerer offered so much more. He cast spells of good luck, a very lucrative endeavor. He also performed cleansing rituals for people who felt that they had been cursed by their enemies. Adolfo knew how to put on a show with his charismatic way and larger-than-life personality. When people left his ritual chamber, they felt fantastic, invigorated, cleansed. Word about this young man with the magical power started to spread around town. Followers soon came knocking. A psychic called Martin Quintana intrigued Adolfo, and he seduced him. Within a year, Martin and another follower and lover called Omar Oria moved in with Adolfo. He referred to Martin as his husband and to Omar as his wife. Adolfo was fortune teller to the rich and famous. Everyone and anyone wanted to book a session with him, models, actors. A doctor and a wealthy property mogul were regular visitors. He also had many powerful clients, including high-ranking police officials. Adolfo was very eager to break into the world of drug cartels, as that was where the big money was. Clearly inspired by his stepfather's lucrative life as a drug dealer back in Miami, he knew how to work his magic, literally. Adolfo manipulated his police clients to introduce him to the leaders of narcotic cartels, and he was in. He swore that his magical powers would not only make the cartels and their drug runners invisible to police, but also bulletproof. Most runners were simple men who were superstitious and grew up believing in brujería or witchcraft. They fell for Adolfo and his magic spells, hook, line, and sinker. All of this came at a price, and Adolfo was filling his pockets faster than you can say voodoo. He had 30 regular clients, some who paid up to $4,500 for one session with the sorcerer. He kept records of all his transactions and journals outlining all of the rituals he had performed. The journal shows that one of his dealer clients paid him $40,000 for 3 years' worth of magical consultations. When the drug lords and their hitmen came for cleansings, Adolfo would bring his A-game. He knew that they would enjoy the violence of sacrifice and perform rituals killing all sorts of animals, snakes, chickens. Prices for sacrifices varied. For instance, a rooster would cost you $6, but a boa constrictor, now that would be $450. A zebra, just over $1,000, and an African lion cub would be $3,100. Cartel bosses took him seriously and even scheduled their shipments based on Adolfo's premonitions. Adolfo realized he had it good, but to keep customers coming back, he was ready to take his magic to the next level. It was time that he started his own Nyanga, the cauldron filled with sacrifices. In 1985, he He took three of his followers to a graveyard, where they dug up human remains to feed the Nyanga. This became regular activity. Adolfo had a charismatic personality. It was easy for him to convince others to do what he wanted to have done. They all believed that he could protect them and did whatever he asked of them. Adolfo Constanzo was obsessed with the notion of protection. He believed that by building a strong Nyanga, he could manipulate all energy from natural powers. He also believed he could manipulate the spirits of the dead. Although Paulo Mayombe forbids it, Adolfo believed that by feeding his Nyanga human sacrifices, it would become the most powerful Nyanga in existence. By perpetually feeding it with live human remains, the magical cauldron would provide even more protection than merely using skeletal bones. Around this time, more than 20 mutilated bodies turned up in Mexico City. Most victims were drug runners or prostitutes, people living and working in the darker side of society. Some were known to him, members of his own cult. There were definite signs of torture on the bodies. Some had organs removed, others had missing limbs. Adolfo believed that adding bodies who had been tortured to his Nyanga would imprison their souls and enable him, as the Palero, to use their souls for evil until the end of time. Adolfo Constanzo's followers worshipped him like a god. Their loyalty to him was intense. Educated people, dangerous men, all believed that he protected them with his spells. His nickname was El Padrino, the Godfather. In 1986, Adolfo was introduced to one of Mexico's most dominant drug cartels, the Calzada family. The head of Interpol in Mexico at the time, Florentino Venturi, made the introduction. Adolfo swiftly won the Calzadas over with his spells of protection and abundance. They believed his magic spells and stuck to him as the cash kept rolling in. Less than a year after becoming involved with the family, he was able to buy himself a $60,000 condo in Mexico City. He loved luxury vehicles and drove a top-of-the-range Mercedes-Benz. And as his wealth and confidence grew, his scams became increasingly brazen. Posing as a DEA agent, he managed to rip off a cocaine dealer in Guadalajara, selling the stash for no less than $100,000. He wasn't the only one lining his pockets. The Calzada family were taking over larger and larger sections of the Latin American drug world. Adolfo believed their success was because of his magic spells. He played a crucial part in their shipment schedule, and he felt that without his protection, law enforcement would have cracked down on them. He approached the Calzada family, demanding that they made him a full business partner of the cartel. The family was not interested and told him to take a hike, a decision that proved to be fatal. In April 1987, Guillermo Calzada and six members of his household mysteriously vanished. When they were reported missing, police went to the home to investigate. They found remnants of a religious ceremony in Guillermo's office, melted candles, and other artifacts related to the practice of Paulo Mayombe. After about a week, police started fishing mutilated bodies out from the Zumpango River. All of the bodies bore signs of torture. Fingers, toes, ears, and even genitals were sliced off. And it got worse. Two of the bodies had their brains removed, and another spine was ripped out. All of these body parts were used to feed Adolfo Constanzo's Nyanga. At the time, police in Mexico City did not have a clue what they were dealing with, and the murders of the Calzada family went unsolved for many years. Adolfo's aspirations to become a drug lord himself was as strong as ever. He used one of his clients, another high-ranking official, in fact, the head of narcotics investigations in Mexico, Salvador Garcia, to introduce him to the Hernandez brothers. The Hernandez family had a history of smuggling drugs across the border into the USA. But after cartel boss Saul Hernandez was shot outside a Matamoros bar in 1987, the structure of the family business was in disarray. Constanzo wanted to join in, promising the family he would cast spells that would make them invisible to law enforcement. The cartel wasn't convinced, but they didn't say no straight away either. Also around this time, he met a 22-year-old student, Sara Maria Aldrete Villarreal. Sara was a striking athletic blonde who stood over 6 feet tall. She lived in Matamoros, a town on the U.S. border. She had resident alien status in the USA, as she was studying at Texas Southmost College in Brownsville. They did not meet by chance. Sara's boyfriend at the time was a well-known Brownsville drug smuggler, but one of the Hernandez brothers, Elio, was infatuated with her. Adolfo realized that Sara could be instrumental in him gaining control of the Hernandez cartel. He orchestrated a seemingly coincidental meeting. Stories go that he purposely drove into her car in downtown Matamoros. Using his magnetic charisma, he drew her into his world. It started with a couple of tarot card readings. As she became more and more entranced by him, he used his power to manipulate her. The two became lovers, and Adolfo told her boyfriend about their affair. The boyfriend ended it, and Sara and Adolfo embarked on a twisted relationship. Although Adolfo was bisexual, he preferred being with men. However, he did seem to be infatuated with Sara and felt that she could be a powerful ally in his cult. Sara understood this, and even though she wasn't as close to him as Martin or Omar, she did not move away from the evil wizard. On the contrary, she was so deep into his world that she became a high priestess of his cult. He gave her the name La Madrina, or the Godmother. Sara, who was known as the honor student in Brownsville by day, became the witch in Matamoros by night. Before long, the Hernandez brothers agreed to take Adolfo in as their new leader. Finally, Adolfo Constanzo had all he ever wanted, money and power. He trusted Sara Aldrete, and she looked after his followers in Mexico when he went on missions to smuggle marijuana across the border to the U.S. Sara was responsible for recruiting more people to join the cult. She would lure men with their striking looks, then tell them about the magical genius of Adolfo Constanzo. Prospective members were made to watch the 1987 film The Believers again and again. The film is about a New York City cult driven to obtain more money and power by sacrificing humans. It was in this time that Adolfo moved to a farm called Rancho Santa Elena, 20 miles or 32 kilometers from Matamoros in the desert. The ranch belonged to one of the Hernandez brothers. On the farm, Constanzo carried on with his sadistic rituals, killing people and using them as human sacrifices to nourish his nyanga. In a small hut on the property, the members of his cult would congregate and engage in ceremonies similar to the ones Adolfo experienced as a child in Haiti. There was a lot of alcohol involved. They smoked cigars, tortured people, and kept the nyanga satisfied. Most of the murder victims were rival drug dealers. But sometimes, a stranger would cross paths with one of the cult members, never to be seen again. Adolfo needed all sorts of people to cast his magic spells. If they wanted to cast a spell that would give the receiver strength, they sourced a muscular man, kidnapped, and killed him. They would then feed the man's muscles to the nyanga. In May 1988, Adolfo shot a drug dealer and a random farmer. But he felt that the offering wasn't enough for the nyanga. They didn't suffer enough before they died. On a trip to Mexico City, he personally supervised the torture and dismemberment of a transvestite called Ramon Esquivel and simply discarded his remains on a public street. It was discovered by local children the next morning. Ovidio Hernandez and his 2-year-old son were kidnapped as the result of a drug war. Adolfo sacrificed a stranger, chanting, praying to his nyanga, that his cult members would be released. They were released the next day, unharmed. Adolfo took full credit for their safe return. This reckless lack of regard for human life meant that Constanzo would sometimes kill his cult members if they disobeyed him. One member, George Valente de Fierro Gomez, was caught using drugs after El Padrino had banned all members from doing so. This was the end of George. One human sacrifice ritual went awry, and the cult had to shoot the victim before the ritual could be completed. The cultists rushed out and picked up a stranger and killed him instead. What they didn't realize was that their victim was the 14-year-old cousin of one of the cult members. But there were no tears. Murder, death, and human sacrifice. It was all a part of everyday life. The cult allegedly also killed children to cast the spell of youth. As the story goes, they once cut a young boy's throat and he started to cry. Constanzo said that it was no good, as it would make the pot sad. So they killed the boy, went out, and got another kid that was riding his bike, and killed him as the better sacrifice. Constanzo wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty, and reportedly preferred to perform most of the torture killing himself. He insisted that his victims had to die screaming. Only if dying while being tortured would he be able to control their souls in casting his spells. Rancho Santa Elena was also where Adolfo and the Hernandez cartel stored huge shipments of cocaine and marijuana. From the outside in, it could look risky, but not to Adolfo's men. He promised them a black magic bubble of protection. A bubble to not only protect them from apprehension by law enforcement, by making them invisible, but also to make them bulletproof. And they honestly believed that if confronted by police, they would be unseen and bullets would simply bounce off of them. In March 1989, El Padrino needed yet another human sacrifice for his Nianga. The last one didn't scream, and he was afraid that this would bring bad luck to the cult. The only way out was to sacrifice another person. He felt they needed a brain, someone who was smart, and ordered his men to bring him an American medical student. This might sound random, but at the time, Matamoros was overrun with American students on spring break. In Texas, this week in March is known as Texas Week, as many colleges break up for the spring at the same time. Brownsville and Matamoros are towns on either side of the border. They are only separated by the Rio Grande River, and a bridge connects the two cities. They coexist for the most part with people living on the one side but working on the other, like Sara Aldrete, who studied in Brownsville but lived in Matamoros. The upside to the easy access for spring breakers is the legal drinking age in Mexico is 16, not 21 like in the U.S., so a quick walk through customs at the border and you can have a night of legally consuming alcohol and having fun. American students flocked there by the thousands. In fact, in March of 1989, there was an estimated 15,000 young people in Matamoros area for spring break. A Monday night, March 13th, 1989, Constanzo's henchmen took to the bars and streets of Matamoros to find their next victim. Mark Kilroy arrived on South Padre Island on March 11th with his friends Billy Huddleston, Bradley Moore, and Brent Martin. Mark was a pre-med student at the University of Texas in Austin and was looking forward to spring break. The group stayed at the Sheraton. It was a constant party, and Monday, the 13th of March, was no exception. The day started at the beach, and after lunch they returned to the beach for the daily Miss Tanline contest. That night, Mark and his friends went to a party on South Padre Island. In the course of the evening, they decided to go to Matamoros as they had done the night before. Around 11 p.m., the group parked on the U.S. side of the border and walked across to Matamoros for a night of partying. They found a bar where the line was short, Los Sombreros. Mark was a handsome, nice guy, and the girls flocked around him. Before he went to UT, he studied at Charleston State on a basketball scholarship. He was athletic, smart, and handsome, with a personality to suit. But at some point, Mark's friends lost sight of him after he met up with a couple of girls. When they found him again, he was leaning against a car, talking to the winner of that day's Miss Tanline competition. Bill and the other guys suggested they head back to the hotel. The four friends walked along the main strip around 2 a.m. There were many people around, and they were socializing as they walked. At some point, Bill ran ahead to find a tree so he could use the toilet. When he was done, he found Bradley and Brent, but Mark was nowhere to be seen. Bradley and Brent said that Mark had also stopped to use the toilet, but he hadn't returned. Bill went back to look for Mark, but he couldn't see him anywhere. The friends thought perhaps Mark had gone across the border already and was waiting at the car, so they went there. But he was not there. Remember, this was in 1989 before everyone carried a cell phone. There was nothing to do but wait and hope that Mark would show up at the car. After 2 hours, at 4 a.m., there was still no sign of Mark. His friends reconciled with the idea that Mark had hooked up with Miss Tanline and that he left to spend the night with her. But that couldn't be further from the truth. Nobody would have thought that in this bustling strip of restaurants and bars, it would be possible to kidnap a person. But when Adolfo Constanzo's men approached Mark, he thought that they were police officers. They were wearing uniforms and said they were arresting him for being drunk in public. They pulled Mark into a van, and he quickly realized that this was no arrest, but rather a kidnapping. As they were driving through the industrial section of Matamoros, the van pulled over so the driver could go to the toilet. Mark took the only chance he had and escaped. He made a run for it and would probably have managed to get away if it wasn't for a second vehicle of cultists that pulled up. Mark was relieved and thought that the occupants of the vehicle would be able to help him. But as it turned out, they were also cultists, the backup car to the van driven by Serafin Hernandez. They immediately tied his hands and bundled him into the car. Then they drove to Rancho Santa Elena, where a tied-up, blindfolded Mark Kilroy was kept overnight. Throughout the night, Mark was tortured and sodomized by unknown attackers. The next morning, an old caretaker brought him some scrambled eggs and water. Most of Mark's face was wrapped in thick silver duct tape, but he did manage to eat a little bit. At 2 p.m. on March 14th, a car pulled up outside of the barn where Mark was held. El Padrino Adolfo Constanzo had arrived, and he was ready to engage in yet another human sacrifice. But they had to be quick with this one, as he had already been in captivity for almost 12 hours. The cult believed that death should occur before the 13th hour. Otherwise, it would mean bad luck for them. They couldn't keep him any longer. They had to kill him. They took Mark into another barn or hut where the Nyanga was kept. It was a dingy and rotten place with a putrid smell. Mark's captors commanded him to lie on his stomach. The fire was lit, and Adolfo's men prepared the Nyanga. Then the ritual kicked off with relentless litany and the burning of sticks. In the haze of smoke, Adolfo Constanzo beheaded Mark Kilroy with a ritualistic machete. The group then proceeded with the ritual by dismembering Mark's limbs. They cut off his legs above his knees so it would be easier to bury him. Then they extracted the prized organ, Mark's brain, and placed it into the hungry, gurgling Nyanga, along with a goat's head, chicken feet, a turtle, a horseshoe, coins, and animal blood. It was a job well done. The Nyanga was nourished, and El Padrino was satisfied. Now their drug operation would carry on undetected, and all of the believers would be protected. Back on South Padre Island, Mark's friends were deeply concerned when he hadn't returned to the hotel the next day. They went back to Matamoros and reported Mark missing at the U.S. Embassy. The vice consul tried to appease them and said he was sure Mark had been arrested by Mexican police and would be released soon. The friends weren't convinced. When they were back on the U.S. side of the border, they reported his disappearance to Cameron County Police. Before this incident, cooperation between law enforcement agencies on both sides of the border had always been good. But as soon as U.S. police approached their Mexican colleagues, they refused to help the Brownsville police. A power struggle between Mexican and American authorities ensued. Mexican authorities said that, according to their records, Mark had crossed the border back to the United States and that there would be no investigation on their side. In America, reports of Mark's disappearance aired daily, but it yielded no results. The constant media attention made U.S. citizens cautious to cross the border into Matamoros, and local businesses started to suffer because of it. Mark's parents, Jim and Helen Kilroy, went to the area to look for their son. They did everything they could, distributed flyers, talked to locals, pressured law enforcement. They even put out a $15,000 reward, but there was no trace of Mark to be found. American police realized there was one man in Mexican law enforcement that would help, no matter what. Comandante Juan Benitez Ayala stood just over 5 feet tall, but once he entered the room, you knew he was someone to be reckoned with. He worked for the Mexican Federal Police and often assisted the DEA and U.S. Customs. He was a vigilante, a true defender of justice. When Mexican authorities followed Serafin Hernandez to Rancho Santa Elena on April 1st, they knew that they had stumbled onto something big. Evidence indicated that this farm was more than just a home base for a drug cartel. In a small shed, they found various items that, at first glance, looked like someone practiced Santeria. But on closer inspection, they found elements that were way more confronting than Santeria offerings. They were dealing with a very dark side of magic. The four cult members arrested that day were two Hernandez brothers and two Martinez brothers. Police recovered state police uniforms. These were the uniforms they used while posing as police officers when they abducted Mark Kilroy. In their cars were red lights, making the cars look like unmarked police vehicles too. When police visited the ranch the next day, they showed the caretaker a photo of Mark Kilroy and asked if he had perhaps seen him. The caretaker confirmed that Mark was the young man he had given breakfast to on the morning of the 14th of March. He did not know what happened to him after that, however. This was the first clue as to what had happened to Mark. In custody, police confronted Serafin Hernandez with the caretaker's information, and he freely admitted to killing Mark Kilroy. On the 11th of April, almost 1 month after Mark's death, police, led by Comandante Juan Benitez Ayala, took Serafin Hernandez to Rancho Santa Elena and asked him to show them where the body was. Hernandez asked, "Which body?" The Comandante was not in the mood for games and made it clear to Hernandez. Hernandez clarified, "I meant which of the bodies would you like me to show you?" Law enforcement officers watched on in amazement as Hernandez walked around and pointed out the locations of one body after the other. "Gilberto was over there. I don't know his last name." Throughout the whole excursion, Hernandez seemed cool and unaffected by the whole situation, still maintaining the attitude that he was invisible, bulletproof, and invincible. At one point, he stopped and said he was hungry. Someone should bring him some food. The Comandante lost it. He grabbed an Uzi and fired it in Serafin Hernandez's direction, and suddenly, as if though a spell were broken, Hernandez realized that he was not bulletproof after all. The Comandante wanted to know where Mark Kilroy was. Hernandez said, "He is over there by the wire." As they walked closer, officers saw the end of a coat hanger stick out of the ground. Hernandez explained that the coat hanger was a marker to show where the shallow grave was, but also that Adolfo Constanzo had threaded it through Mark Kilroy's spine with the intention of digging it up later and to use it as a necklace. On the first day of exhumation alone, they recovered 13 bodies from the ranch. Hernandez admitted to his part in the murders, which occurred over a 9-month period. All the bodies were badly mutilated. Some were castrated, some were sodomized, and most of them were missing limbs or organs. Among the bodies were two renegade federal narcotics officers, Joaquin Manzo and Miguel Garcia. Some bodies were never identified. In total, 23 bodies were dug up. Hernandez also told police about the cult's leader, El Padrino Adolfo Constanzo. He explained that the murders were ordered by Constanzo in order to feed his nyanga. With no remorse, he outlined exactly what took place at ritual sacrifices. Mark Kilroy's family were understandably devastated by the news. They are a family of faith. The only comfort they had was that Mark was with his maker. His mother tried to make sense of the horrific circumstances of his death. She felt that his killers must have been possessed by the devil. There could be no other explanation for the monstrous murder of her son. police were on the hunt for Adolfo Constanzo. They learnt about his cleansing ceremonies in Mexico City and went there to raid his properties. In his luxury home at Atizapan, just outside Mexico City, they found stacks of gay pornography and Constanzo's much-valued book of spells and recipes. The book also named some of his high-profile clients. If the contents were to be made public, it would have caused a massive uproar. Constanzo could have been anywhere. With a lot of media coverage, sightings of the Black Magic Polaro were reported as far north as Chicago. In fact, when Serafin Hernandez drove through the police roadblock, he had just been in Brownsville, where he had met with Adolfo, Sara Aldrete, Martin Quintana, and some other cult members. When they learned about the arrests at Rancho Santa Elena, they drove to McAllen in Texas, about an hour away from Brownsville, and boarded a flight to Mexico City. The Comandante knew how to lure El Padrino out of hiding. With a deep understanding and respect for Mexican superstition and belief in witchcraft, or brujería, he approached a practitioner of white magic to counter Adolfo Constanzo's black magic. He asked the Brujos to protect him and his task force against the forces of evil. But mostly, he wanted to know what they could do to smoke El Padrino out of his hiding spot. The Brujos suggested they burn down the ritual chamber on the ranch, as well as the revered Nyanga. The Comandante commissioned a Mexican TV crew to accompany them, and they filmed the Brujos pouring accelerant over the pot and round the hut and set it alight. On live television, the whole nation could see how Constanzo's temple of human sacrifice turned into cinders. That same night, Adolfo Constanzo was located. He was hiding out in an apartment in Mexico City. Incidentally, a couple of days before, Sara Aldrete dropped a note out of the window which read, "Please call the police and tell them that in this building are those that they are seeking. Give them the address, fourth floor. Tell them that a woman is being held hostage. I beg for this because what I want most is to talk or they're going to kill the girl." A pedestrian found the note but thought it was a joke, so did not take it to police. On the 6th of May, 1989, the same day that the Comandante had El Padrino's hut burnt down, a neighbor reported a disturbance at an apartment in Mexico City. The commotion was caused by none other than Adolfo Constanzo. When he saw the broadcast, he was outraged. Sara Aldrete later told police that he started burning loads of cash on the stove, saying that he didn't need it anymore. He also threw some money out of the window, dollar bills, coins. When police arrived, they did not know what they were walking into. As far as they knew, it was a domestic disturbance, nothing more. When Adolfo saw police vehicles pull up in front of the building, he mistakenly thought that they had been located, ready to go down. He opened fire with an automatic firearm. Police retaliated, and within minutes, the building was surrounded by 180 armed officials. The bullet-riddled siege lasted for an excruciatingly long 45 minutes. Determined not to go to prison, Adolfo Constanzo handed a gun to his best hitman, a cult member they called El Dubi. He ordered El Dubi to kill him and the love of his life, Martin Quintana. He wanted to die in Martin's arms. El Dubi told police what was said between him and El Padrino. "He told me to kill him and Martin. I told him I couldn't do it, but he hit me in the face and threatened me that everything would go bad for me in hell. Then he hugged Martin, and I just stood in front of them and shot them with a machine gun." By the time police reached the apartment, both Adolfo Constanzo and Martin Quintana were dead. El Dubi and Sara Aldrete were immediately arrested. Theories exist that Mexican police killed Adolfo Constanzo, and that it was not an assisted suicide, as the official record claims. He had so much information on corrupt high-level officials, had he been arrested, they would all have been ratted out, no doubt. The only way to ensure their anonymity was to make sure he did not talk. More than a year later, in August 1990, El Dubi, who was said to have murdered Adolfo and Martin, was convicted for their murders and given a 30-year prison sentence. Omar Oria, Constanzo's wife, was convicted along with two other cult members for the murder of Ramon Esquivel in Mexico City, and they were all given 35 years in prison. However, Omar Oria died of AIDS before he was sentenced. Sara Aldrete, Elio Hernandez, and Serafin Hernandez were convicted of multiple murders and were ordered to serve prison sentences of over 60 years each. Should any of them be released from prison, American authorities are ready to prosecute them for Mark Kilroy's murder. After the deaths of Adolfo Constanzo and Martin Quintanas, Martin's sister told police that Adolfo's first madrina, or godmother, was still out there practicing black magic in Guadalajara. Before Omar Oria died, he said that the death of El Padrino and the cult's captivity was not the end of their religion. He was confident that the blend of religions that Adolfo Constanzo had created, a mixture of Palo Mayombe, Santeria, and Haitian voodoo, would live on. The press dubbed the group the Narco-Satanists, but that was not what they were at all. They used widely practiced religions and pushed the limits by including human sacrifice within their rituals. The three religions Constanzo drew from had no manual or written doctrine. Rituals and beliefs were passed on from one generation to the next as part of an oral tradition. Traditionally, only heterosexual men are allowed to practice Palo Mayombe. Adolfo Constanzo broke this rule by being bisexual, and even more, by bringing in a woman as a high priestess. This woman did not only cast spells, she actively participated in torturing victims. Sara Aldrete claimed that she was unaware of the human sacrifices and that she would never have been part of the cult had she known the extent of their practices. This is hard to believe, as she was ordained as a high priestess, Adolfo Constanzo's second in command, chosen above his life partners or business companions. Mark Kilroy's parents had the unthinkable task of rebuilding their lives without their son. In the wake of events, countless people reached out to them with stories of young people who were injured or killed as a result of the drug trade. To ensure Mark did not die in vain, his family established the Mark Kilroy Foundation with the aim to prevent drug-related violence and to educate and rehabilitate at-risk youths. The link to the foundation is in the show notes if you'd like to check it out. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. Also, visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/evidencelockerpodcast to see more about today's case. If you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. We would also appreciate if you could review the episodes, as it gives us some street cred in the world of podcasting. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.